Today is Friday, September 8th, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Susan Eichhorn, who retired in 2001 as Research Program Manager in the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Letters and Science Botany Department. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We're going to start by asking you to talk about your early life, where you were born, where you went to elementary school, high school. Were there any people in your life that influenced you in the area of science or in your future education, your future profession, your family, what your parents did? Did you have any siblings? Anything that you want to tell us about early life?
So let me ramble on.
Ramble on.
Well, I was from a small town in Illinois, northern Illinois, name of Deerfield. But I was born in Highland Park next door because Deerfield did not have a hospital. So I was not born in my hometown, so to speak. I grew up on what was an old family farm. We had several acres of land left, and there were many acres around us that was free for us kids to play on because we didn't know who owned it and nobody bothered us. But I have four siblings, an older brother and sister, and a younger brother and sister. My older brother and sister were about, or still are, about 5 and 6 years older than I, and I was a tag along, but they put up with me. But we had a marvelous time, at least I think so. We lived more than a mile from town, so we had to walk or ride our bikes more than a mile to see a friend, and friends weren't usually coming down to see us because we lived on the highway and there was no sidewalk. So we made it through life of being on a busy highway, but other people didn't want their children to do that. So we and very few neighbor kids, very few, and I would play in the old barn, and we had a shed which stored marvelous things like big jugs of gasoline that were stored because they were gasoline was rationed, and my father would take the gasoline out and put it in the car when he needed it. We had a two-story chicken coop, which my brother and sister and I turned into what we called the hut. This was a marvelous structure for kids. We had, my sister and I had the downstairs, my brother had the upstairs. And we would invent all kinds of things. It was a schoolroom one day, it was a house another day.
So the chickens weren't there.
But no, no chickens. They were long gone, and okay. So were the cows and the horses. So we all we had were cats and dogs to play with as far as animals. But some of the old structures were there, and we made good use of them. And we made good use of the land around us by tree climbing and making forts out of one thing or another. Winter it would be snow forts, of course, and we would be gone for hours, and parents never seemed to worry about us, but they had a device to get us home, and you could hear it far away, and that was the old dinner bell. And when you heard that clanging, and it might be very soft because you're so far away, you come home immediately, and we did. Sometimes it was because of chores, and sometimes it was come and eat. As far as school is concerned, the school too was more than a mile away. We had to walk there or ride our bikes there. In the winter, we might get a ride sometimes, but ordinarily we tramped through that snow and ice. It was kindergarten through eighth, so I spent 9 years there, and I must say that in the later years I was very bored because I didn't think we were given as much of interest to learn, mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's true of many children, that you have classrooms of 33 people, what's the teacher supposed to do?
Sure.
But my love was reading, and I remember something, and I guess we were in eighth grade, we had to fill out various forms because we're going to high school, what did you like, et cetera, et cetera. What were your hobbies? And I put down as my hobby reading. And I thought, I hope nobody sees this other than the teachers, because I was embarrassed to think somebody would think, oh, reading is a hobby. You know, everybody else probably put, you know, baseball and all that kind of thing. But I put reading, and maybe other children did. I have no idea what my classmates said. But I did find school getting quite boring, and I guess my outlet was to read at home.
Was it a good public library?
Well, it was a small town, and perhaps for its size it was. It's hard to know, but I can remember something happening to me. The teachers took their classes to the library once a week, so there was an encouragement to read. And for the very early grades, one through three, maybe one through four, there was a table, and on those tables were first graders, second graders, were books. Well, I had exhausted all the books on my table, and I am first, second grade, I don't know which it was. And I went to the next table, and the teacher came over and said, "This table." Okay. Well, I got around that one, too. I just had my sister take books out for me. I'd tell her which ones I'd want, and then she'd check them out for me. So there was a control that I didn't think was right.
Yeah.
But how does one fight it? I don't know. But as I say, my sister bailed me out on that. I don't know much else to say about
grade
school.
What about high school,
really,
then?
Well, high school was in the next town, Highland Park, where I was born, and rode buses many miles a day to get there. And that I liked. It was a challenge. I can remember my freshman year getting my first report card, and I had something like 3 B's and a C or something like that, or maybe 4 B's. And I thought, oh, I always did better in grade school. So I found out we had to work, and so next 6 week period, I upped all those grades, mm-hmm. And it was interesting. When I started the high school, I think there were only about 900 students. By the time I graduated, there were more like 1,600. So there was
a big
grade,
big,
you know, jump. And well, who knows? I mean, we were born in the end of the 30s, so.
Yeah.
You're getting now into World War I era kids coming in behind you.
Sure.
And the work there was challenging and interesting, and I had some very good teachers. In fact, overall, the teachers were very good at that high school. It was a very highly rated high school in the country, and perhaps still is. But there's personalities, and I had my favorites. But I didn't really feel that there was a... But on the teacher's part, that there was a distinction between the boys and the girls as far as what work you had to do and what was expected of you, that kind of thing. I never got that kind of feeling. And my parents always encouraged us to read and study and always helped us.
Had they gone to college?
Yes. My father finished a degree in chemistry, and my mother dropped out in her senior year because my parents got married. She was pregnant and didn't feel well, so, you know, same old
right.
story. She regrets that she didn't get that degree. And my grandfather and grandmother on my father's side were also college graduates, so there was emphasis on education.
Right.
And as I say, my parents always helped us in grade school or high school. If we had trouble, they'd help. They'd say, "Did you read the instructions?"
Hmm.
Well, go read the instructions and see if you can do it, and if you can't, come back. So we weren't automatically helped just because we asked for it.
Right.
We had to show that we really, really needed it. So,
mm-hmm. So
there was, go ahead.
Was there a college prep?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you were pretty much programmed before you came in.
Okay.
And the high school had three, as I recall, had three basic levels. One college bound, one may or maybe not, but had some kind of solid core. And then there were the carpentry shop, the students who would not be interested in furthering an education, might even drop out. I don't know what the dropout figure was. But they had automotive studies, and they even built a house or helped build a house. I mean, they had a lot of skills, so that the students who were going to be in the blue collar jobs, so to speak, were given a good background in
mm-hmm.
it. And I imagine a lot of the middle level students went on to some kind of further training, but I have no idea. So we were tracked. So my class was around 340, and we were usually in the same classes with each other. It depended. I mean, if you took different languages or took more of certain areas, and you wouldn't see them in every class, but you saw the same people frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be in the same as several people daily. at the time I was in high school, students were given a lot of physical education. It was something like three times a week in freshman, but I mean, a senior took it every day, so they put a lot of time into that, and after school sports kind of thing.
For girls?
For girls and boys. Now, there weren't competitions or schools for girls at that time, but after school activities, whether it was field hockey or basketball, swimming, etc. Mm. Those were there all the time. I participated in a number of those team sports. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was an interesting culture. My little hometown was basically white, probably more Anglo, or at least European than anything else, and mostly you were Christian or nothing, and when you went to Highland Park, you met that a third or a half of them were Jewish versus, and also that one of the towns involved was called Highwood, and that had a very heavy Italian background population. So you suddenly met a lot of peoples that you didn't associate with before because sure. they weren't in your little small town and small school. We were only 5 miles apart or so, but I mean, you were kind of isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. It was didn't bother me. I mean, that was welcome to me.
Sure.
I had no problem with that, and I don't think there were problems in general concerning people. It was more high school cliques, you know, you were this
right.
group of kids or that group of kids, and they may be very well mixed as far as all the peoples that were there.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry that there were cliques sometimes, because there are people I would have liked to have known,
mm-hmm.
and what are they doing today,
right.
kind of thing. So, and sometimes, not that it bothered me a lot, but there was a definite difference in sometimes in the cliques, because there was money and no money, virtually.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. you'd sit there in your homeroom session, the girls would be talking about how many new sweaters they got or something like this, and I'm thinking, Gad, I have to babysit and buy one. So, but it didn't really bother me. I mean, I didn't feel that I was lesser because, but it's just that, you know, that was reality, and mm-hmm. it didn't bother me. I'm sure it bothers some people, but it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
So hand-me-downs were hand-me-downs.
Right.
I mean, that's what we had.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, you said that you had some very good teachers. Can you think of any in particular that...
Oh, yeah, partly it was fondness, but I mean, they were good teachers, but partly... my mathematics teacher for my junior and senior years was the same teacher my father had, and she was a very wonderful woman. I think I'm not sure whether she was from Maine or Nova Scotia, but she talked like it, you know, and the answer is a boot, and then she'd read it off, and we were looking in the book to find where she got this. And she was just very subtle in how she got people to do things and to observe things. I can remember one of his teachers I had for was some of the American government things were very good, and they were basically all really interested in the student. As I say, these were, from my understanding, these teachers really competed to get those slots in that high school.
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect, you may not like the teacher maybe for some reason, but that they knew their material and taught very well. There's probably some others, but you put me on the spot,
that's
I'm trying to
think. Right. No, that's, now, but, then you felt prepared for college.
Oh, yeah, and mm-hmm. it became very evident one day. I think, I was an undergraduate in a dormitory, and I remember having to be sitting at lunch with one of the, I forgot what they're called, the house something, not the house mother, but they were graduate students. There were about three of them. We had three floors. There were three graduate women. And I remember asking them how, she asked the students at the table how they were doing and how hard it was, and I said, oh, fine with me, I have no trouble. Others were struggling.
Hmm.
So I think that I was well prepared relative to a lot of students.
Yeah.
I knew that you'd have to work hard. And
now, how did you choose, where did you go to college and how did you choose that?
Well, I went to the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, and I really had virtually no choice. I mean, money was scarce. I mean, mm-hmm. we weren't poor, but like many people coming out of the Depression and World War II, is that you may be quite well educated, but you know, jobs just didn't pay a lot. If you had several kids, you couldn't afford to send them all. So I did get a scholarship that paid my, from the high school that paid my tuition for one semester. Mm-hmm. And in the summer, I worked to the maximum one was allowed before being taxed. And taxing your parents, I don't think that rule is there anymore, but right. It was something like you could earn $600 or something, and then you stop because you're going to make your parents pay yeah. more taxes, and they didn't need that. They needed the. So I would say I certainly paid by working for half of my tuition and fees and dormitory, I would say. Things were a lot less fancy then. Mm-hmm. But certainly my parents had to put in at least half of, probably half. They probably put a little better than half of my whole career, so, mm-hmm. or undergraduate career. And I did it in 4 years because it just, you did it. You didn't have time to find more money to take right. another year to do something more. So, considering finances, mm-hmm. I didn't have much choice. And like, the land-grant colleges, they're very good. And so that's where I went. Mm-hmm. And of course I was scared, will I get in or not? Mm-hmm. But I did. Yeah. So
it was a positive experience?
Oh yeah, very much so. And it's the same place my grandparents and father and mother had gone to also, so it was interesting.
How about your brother, your older brother and sister?
My older brother went to Northwestern for a while. He didn't finish his degree there. In fact, when he moved to Utah after he got married, he continued, but I don't think he finished his engineering degree, but he certainly had enough of it. He did very well in life, so I can't complain. My older sister went to nursing school. She would have liked to have gone to a college and gotten the bachelor's too, but it just wasn't in the picture. They were both in college at the same time, basically. Mm. So, and she's still working as a nurse to this day. My younger sister, well, she started out college, trying to think, Butler in Indiana, and she started out in the dance school or school of music, I'm not sure where that was, but academic life just wasn't for her, so she never went beyond about a part of her sophomore year. My younger brother didn't think much of academics at the time and went off and joined the military for 20 or more years, and then after that he, without telling many people in the family, he went to one of the local junior colleges and did a, what do they call it, associate's degree or something like mm-hmm. that by going to school in the evening because he wanted to prove to himself he could do it. And I'm told he did very well. Mm-hmm. But he certainly ended up encouraging his children to educate because both his children have college degrees. So mm-hmm. He was just, I guess, a late bloomer there,
right.
what they call it.
Now, so, did you know what you wanted to be when you started college? Or
well, as far as what I wanted to be as job, no, I didn't mm-hmm. really. I knew I wanted to do more studies, and I was very impressed by that high school teacher, junior and senior year. So I majored in math, which, mm-hmm. as it turned out, should not have been my major. It should have been my minor if I was going to do it, because I liked biology very much. So I did my minor in zoology and genetics. But what I was going to do with it, I don't know.
So you weren't in the teacher track?
No, I wasn't interested in being a teacher at mm-hmm. all. It just wasn't, I didn't feel I was cut out for it. This wasn't what I wanted to do. Though I know the guidance counselor at the high school thought that was a good track for women. I didn't say anything, I just let her tell me this.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know what I was going to do with this. And late in, well, it's almost graduation time, my parents informed me that they had a friend who said he may have a job for me. And so I went home and went to see him, and it turned out this was the person he had in mind for me was a professor he had worked with on some research project. Well, it wasn't his major professor, I mean, they were both professors and in science. And so I went up to Madison to interview with this professor, and he hired me. And it was really pretty much data collecting and managing, nothing fancy really, but it involved knowing about animals and data collected on physiological aspects of animals. And that's how I got to Wisconsin.
That's interesting. So this was a friend of your family?
A friend of my family was a researcher himself.
Okay.
And had worked with, he wasn't a professor, excuse me, he wasn't, but he was a PhD, and he had worked with this professor at UW. In the zoology department. So the fellow hired me.
Who was it?
Yes, it was Peter Morrison in the department. He left long ago I hadn't been here long when things I had to get pulled together for him and all and such were involving getting a research station set up in Alaska. And I'd proofread these things that come back from the typists, and there was my name and several other people's names from the department who were, you know, not students or academic staff. And he had listed our names as being positions to go there without even telling us.
Oh my gosh.
And so we were learning of this, and I thought, well, he didn't ask me, you know, and he didn't ask the other people. There were three or four of us named. And, so the day he asked, Dr. Morrison asked me if I'd go to Alaska, and I said, well, no, I couldn't do that because I was getting married. I don't know what the others gave as excuses. My excuse was true.
Right.
But they did get this research lab set up in Alaska. I mean, I'm sure it was very interesting. It's just that my plans were otherwise. Mm-hmm. But to be incorporated in somebody's plans without being notified is not what I like to hear.
No.
So, but it was nice. I mean, he thought enough of my work, which was really kind of unskilled in certain respects, because I wasn't really researching at all. I was really doing support to him as far as putting data together that he'd collected and proofreading and things like that. Mm-hmm. So my nose was in, you know, animal science all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happened after you got married then?
Well, I was without a job.
Yeah.
so I went knocking on doors in
So did you marry somebody who was working here on campus?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes, I did. He was a graduate student and an academic staff member in zoology.
Yeah. And his name?
His name is Henry Eichhorn.
Okay.
And he was associated with the Laboratory of Limnology under Arthur Hassler. And most people call him Ike, I usually call him Henry, but he pretty much ran the lab, the limnology lab, and he really did a lot of advising of graduate students. Now, he's much older than I am, mm-hmm. and that made him much older than, well, considerably older than most of the graduate students. And he had a very firm hold of science, and so he was in a position to be able to give advice to these graduate students. And he did a lot of writing of the research proposals for Dr. Hassler, and did a lot of work in getting the money by writing research proposals to get mm-hmm. the money to build the limnology laboratory. That's not known mm-hmm. particularly, but he did a lot of the footwork that helped get that lab built.
Mm-hmm. So were you looking for jobs in the sciences or were you just looking for a job?
Well, no, I wanted to be in the sciences, and I'm trying to think how I happened to go to the botany department, which same building, but I mean, I'm trying to, I really don't remember mm-hmm. how I got, you know, directed, but I got a job, with a zoology, a botany professor for one semester, and then I went, in the summer, I did a job for the horticulture department, and by this time then I knew some people in botany, so the grad students and such. And this gal who had been setting up some of the botany labs, teaching labs, was leaving. And she said, why don't I try for that job? So I did, and I got it. And I did that for, it was either 4 or 5 years.
And what year was that?
It must have been fall of 63.
Okay.
And so I worked for three professors in the fall. It was a team taught course, botany course. Three of them taught it. And I set up their labs for the students. And then the spring course was only taught by one person, and that's Ray Everett, and I've been with him ever since. So, well, there's a little bit of gap in there, which we can talk about. But basically, that's how I got in botany. As I say, the first step, I don't remember what directed me to this person. Maybe it could be that I went into the department office and just asked if somebody were looking. That's probably how it was. Because I didn't really know anybody in Bonnie at the time. I'd recognize people because I'd pass them in the hallway all the time. But so for about 4 years I did that job. It could have been five, but I think it was four. And I did that in the summer too, and that would be with a visiting person. They had always had a visitor teaching the summer course. But it was basically the same thing. And frankly, it was getting to be boring because I'd done the same things over and over, and there wasn't anywhere to go as far as I was concerned. And it happened at that time that my husband, a fellow who'd gotten his PhD under Hassler some years previous was director of what was going to be is the National Aquarium. Now, this was to be built in Washington. It was a fabulous structure they were going to build. And he lured my husband to Washington to work there. And so we moved to Washington. And that was 60... If I'd thought of this before, I could tell you. It must have been about 67... Yeah, okay, right. It must have been 67, 68. So we moved to Washington thinking we weren't coming back. And unfortunately, that lab, that research facility never got built. It was there was, and maybe still is, an aquarium in the basement of the Interior Building. But this was to be a beautiful structure, partly research, partly museum for people to visit. Unfortunately, there were only about two members of Congress who were really behind this, and they retired, and the money disappeared. So what's now called the National Aquariums in Baltimore, it's not the same kind of facility that would have been built in Washington. But so that came to an end, so we came back to Madison, because I got a job here, and so I came back. And so I went and knocked on doors. But I should back up a little bit. In Washington, I had nothing to do. And I thought, what am I going to do with myself? So I thought, well, I better find a job. So I thought, well, I love universities. I really like being in them. So I went down to American University. And I'm not sure if it was a biology department or botany department now, but I went in and I was filling out a form. And all of a sudden, there's this woman standing next to me, and Susan, I said, yes, and she said, come talk to me. You know, she happened to be a professor at American in science, and she was looking for teachers to teach at Yeshiva High School.
Oh, my.
An Orthodox high school. And, well, okay, so I talked to her, and I thought, I mean, she hired me on the spot, and I'm thinking, I don't teach, I don't know what to do, you know. She had the books already chosen, basically.
To teach biology?
To teach math and biology. And I'm thinking, what do I do, you know. Well, she told me how many students there. Well, it turns out there were, for the boys, there were only two boys who would be about freshman level, and they were both needed a lot of help. The rabbis finally told me that they had a little bit of emotional trouble, at least one of them did. So it was really one-on-one with these two boys with algebra. And so that was fun. And these kids, one was from Panama, I forgot where the other one was from, but they were both boarding with other families and went to this high school. And for the girls, well, I had to travel up to Silver Spring, and there were about 12 of them. And I think of them every once in a while thinking, my gosh, they're probably grandmothers by now. But they were interesting. The biology we went over was very rudimentary because there was absolutely no equipment or anything else. And it was fun. And the math was more structured because I had two groups. One of them was, I don't know, maybe algebra. one was more advanced. I can't remember for sure. But they were very interesting girls to talk to because they lived differently. They weren't orthodox in the sense that, you know, some of them are virtually covered with clothing. I mean, they looked very modern. You'd never know that they were orthodox girls, except that they followed sundown rules on the Sabbath, and we had to always close up and zoom out of there so I'd get them home on time and before sundown and things like that. And they talk a lot about being and living in Orthodox families. Well, all my Jewish friends were not at all Orthodox. Sure. You know, there was no kosher food or anything else. It was, we were just people, you know.
Right.
But there, you know, they would tell you about what Orthodox life was like.
Hmm.
And it was interesting because I said, well, what do you do on Sabbath when you can't do anything? Because I'd never talked to an Orthodox person before. And I said, oh, we have fun. We talk and play games, but we just can't turn on lights. We can't cook, you know, these various things. Interesting to see, because this was very different from what a high school girl would be out, what I'm used to.
Sure.
Not a very different world. Friday, I mean, you went to movies, and
right.
You know, you went out and ate pizza and all kinds of things. So it was a very nice revelation to me of what life was like for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my backtracking. And anyway, we came back to Madison. I didn't have a job, of course. So it was, well, go knock on doors.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to the body department. And I don't remember how many people I talked to, but I talked, of course, as I was saying, Ray and I had a nice talk. And he said he wasn't sure, I don't know. But at any rate, I don't know if it was that evening or maybe it was a couple days later, he called me and he said, I have something in mind, come back and talk to me again. So I went back and talked to him. And his eventual goal was he wanted to write his own botany textbook and that he needed somebody to work with him. Well, little misreading is my
right.
is my favorite pastime, and so I was all ears for if it was a book. But there were several things that had to come first. One was that I would have to work on a master's degree, and I would have to, and also I would have a job with him within a year, I guess it was. And what it was is that he could hire me as a student helper for a while, but then when this gal who had this job under him finished her PhD, she'd be leaving and that slot would be open. And he couldn't justify giving me that position unless I was working on a master's degree, because this was the conditions of the money. Now the money came from came from the University of Iowa Letters and Science, and that was only, I think, half. The monies came from that, the other half came from his research grant from National Science Foundation. So anyway, I did become a graduate student, and for the first semester worked as an hourly helper for him. And
did you go full-time for him?
Yeah, I was full-time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I carried the full load, at least that first year. I carried another, so it was a couple of courses and seminar. So it was either after a semester or a year, then I got the slot as an academic staff member, but at which time then I only took, I may have still taken two courses.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of coursework to make up, really, because I didn't have all the background that was required. One of them was a chemistry class. I hadn't had any chemistry outside of high school, and I did all right in it, but it wasn't, it didn't thrill me.
Yeah.
My father would have said it was duck soup. You know, it's easy. Well, for me, I thought chemistry, it fascinates me, but it's not what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, so I had to do some minimum requirements like that. And I had to take some introductory botany, zoology. So I didn't get graduate credit for those, of course. So there were two, maybe three courses I had to take as background to make me a true, full-blown graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book idea was in the background all this time. And we didn't know when or where, but it was going to happen someday. So I did research with him on plant structure, in particular tissue that he was interested in. And it was all right. I did it. I did a good job for a minute, but it wasn't what I really want to do. I was waiting for that, when are we going to work on a book kind of thing. Well, then, my husband lost his funding to do the job. There's no necessity to go into that. And so he was still in the military as a reserve. And he'd do his once a week or once a month, whatever it was they had to do in his 2 weeks. And he was sent out, or he wasn't sent out, but he accepted his required military slot for the summer out in Maryland at the United States Army Environmental Hygiene Agency. Well, he was losing his funding, and he was offered a couple jobs. So he accepted one of them, and I said, I'm not sure I can go with you. Now, this sounds like, you know, a disruption, a ruining of a marriage. It wasn't really, but I mean, that book was there, and I wanted to do that. And my husband is not the kind who would say, well, I'm going, you have to go with me. There's mm-hmm. never any of that, never has been. So we worked out that I'd stay here, and I'd travel back and forth to see him.
And he would be in Maryland?
He would be in Maryland. Mm-hmm. And we did that for something like 17 years.
Really?
Yes.
So you were one of the, you two were probably one of the first couples that well, I'm sure there are more, but that's...
Probably. And interesting, I always found it interesting, this, of course, this, what I'm telling you now has happened over a number of years, but I'd talk to complete strangers. You'd talk to somebody on a plane or something, and the women always understood it. The men never did, whether they were colleagues of my husband's or talk with a stranger on the plane or somebody back here. The women always understood the situation, but the men didn't. They worried about, well, you know, and you'd say, well, say it. And they would never, but I knew it was, you know, worried about, well, some other man's going to pick you up, or, you know. And the women were like, Dad, you can lead your life and still have a marriage, you know. So I found that fascinating. Yeah. And it'd be interesting to know whether there's that attitude of mine is prevalent in a lot of women today. Uh-huh. Now, if we'd had children, we wouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. Growing up is stressful enough. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't subject children to doing that kind of thing. So it worked out for us, but I don't think it would work out for it. That's just too far away.
Yeah.
I mean, if one's in Milwaukee, one's in Madison, that's one thing, but if you're 700 miles away or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So, and also you have to be somewhat of a loner to be without each other for, and usually it was 6 weeks or so, and then be gone a week, sometimes 2 weeks, but that back and forth all the time, that can add stress. And it got to be a pain in the butt, excuse me, after a while, so I was glad when he finally retired and came back here, because he always wanted to come back here, and he always wanted me to stay in that house, not rent it. He said, that's our home, you're going to stay there. It sounds like a demand, right? You're going to stay there. But that's what he did. He came back. And it was about the time when I'd say, this has got to stop. I'm really tired of getting on that plane and going back and forth. But interestingly enough, when you said this, I was probably early on in this,
right?
Is that after I've been doing this a few years, and I can't tell you how many, and it's not important really, but it had been several, and that is they hired a woman who was married, and her husband was in Michigan, because he hadn't finished his degree. So periodically, she would be gone, but she couldn't be as gone as frequently and as for long a time as I was. And she felt that the fact that, though I was academic staff and she was faculty, she mm-hmm. thought that the fact that the faculty knew that I did my work and left and came back and left, that I got my work done, even though I was gone longer than my allotted vacation time. Right. And she felt that this helped her in those first few years. That mm-hmm. yes, women can do this, mm-hmm. and she didn't have children at the time yet either. So, I guess that long separation really helped somebody else, and I'm glad mm-hmm. to know that it did.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you meet other? I mean, for 17 years, you must have then met other people on campus that were doing that, going through that same.
No,
really?
No, I'm not saying that they weren't there.
Yeah,
it's just that was not my experience.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have that kind of interaction with faculty members in other departments. Now, she might have, but I don't know. I'm not surprised if there were others. But, and it may have hurt her if the faculty didn't know that, yes, she can do her job here, go away, and come back and not get behind, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that, and, you know, she was an assistant professor, as you mentioned. Yeah. That's a tough job. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time involved in it, so. But it got to be difficult after a while. It was just, it was the travel part, getting on that plane and back and forth. It was just, didn't want to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I had undergraduates living in my house with me, a couple at a time. It was a couple at one point, and another time it was two girls who were under. And so I had somebody there who could shovel the snow and feed the cats and and such.
Yeah.
But it got to be a real drag.
Well, talk about the research work that you did with Professor Evert and the publications that came from that collaboration.
Well, I did some of the research for him in the sense that I did a lot of collecting of the plant material and preparing it for use in electron microscope, and I did some of the what's called sectioning, the thin sections that you have to put on these little grids to put in the electron microscope. But I didn't really do the studying of the tissue itself. He did that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did the, as I say, I did the preparations for him. After, I don't know, maybe a year or so, I'm not sure when I started. Well, I developed the film for him, but it was a while before I started doing the printing for him. So after a couple of years, I was preparing the material, not only up to the time he'd view it, but I would, as I say, develop the film, and I would make the prints for him to use to study the what he had looked at. And I'm not sure when I began typing the manuscripts, because I'm not a great typist to this day, but I mean, eventually I did with computers, I did, so because you can easily correct your mistakes. And after a time, maybe a year or two, he started giving me the job of preparing the plates. In other words, you take the information he wanted that was on the photographs, he would let me trim them. He decided where, but then I'd trim them and mount them on the plates, and then he'd label them. So I gradually picked up more and more of what he was doing as far as preparation of the manuscript. As far as the study and interpretation, that was not my job to do that, but I did everything else around it. And he always honored me by putting my name on it, even though I wasn't part of the writing itself or the study.
Mm-hmm.
And that book still wasn't in sight as far as working on it. You know, years were going by. It wasn't happening. So it was about 1972, somewhere around there, that he was approached by a publisher to help work on a book that had already been published. So there was a first edition out, and this was the question whether to hire him to be a joint author on a second edition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he told the publisher that he had always had in mind that he would write a book with my input, and that he was not going to give that up. So what worked out in the end was he was taken on that book as the second author. There were two authors on the first book, but he became the second, and the second became the third, with the understanding that eventually my name would be on that book in further editions.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how it worked out, is that gradually, after about two editions, the third author was dropped. And I was added as the third author. Now, again, I'm not really the writer, but I'm the one who did the literature searches and pulled things together. I prepared the manuscript. I kept track of all the artwork, interacted with the editor to save him time, because he had his graduate students and research and everything else to do. So it has become a long-term kind of love affair with this one book, and we're in the seventh edition.
Oh,
yes,
my.
We've been working since the second edition on this book. And
you found your true calling.
I found my true calling.
Uh-huh.
Now, for a while, I still had the research material to work on, and Oh, I should back up a bit. You asked me about funding. When I first took the job, it was half funded by his research grant and half funded by Letters and Science. Early on, and this would be back in the early 70s sometime, he negotiated getting the Letters and Science picked up the entire salary so that any monies in his research grant for graduate students and all was available for him to hire somebody else. So eventually, I went off that job, and he was able to fund somebody to take my place in doing that work of collecting the materials and preparing it for electron microscopy and doing the films and the prints. But I still had the part of the manuscript helping and also doing the plates for the illustrations for those.
But you were funded by Letters.
But I was. Sometime in the 70s, I was entirely, so I couldn't tell you what year, was entirely paid by Letters and Science.
Which was a good thing.
Was a good thing for me, because it was solid money.
Sure.
So when things got tighter and tighter, I was still there to work all those hours for him.
Mm-hmm.
But it became a source of, I think, jealousy for the department, faculty. Because money got tighter and tighter as far as what the colleges had to give to professors. Ray Everett, was a star in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier on, not many professors were doing as much research then as now. I mean, the emphasis became more and more research and find your own funding kind of thing. So here was this professor who had an academic staff member paid for by the by the college, and nobody else had that kind of money. So it was kind of a sore point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the details, and I wouldn't want to mention names. Even if I knew them, well, I know some of them, where they challenged this. And one time it happened, and one of the other professors came and told me what was afoot. And Ray was on sabbatical somewhere. I don't know if it was Europe or South Africa. I don't remember which. It was at that particular time.
Timing,
so I contacted him and said, hey, boy, did he ever get in contact with the dean right fast?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and he said, I want a clarification of that position. And they said, as long as Ray was in good graces with the college and that I was doing what he asked me to do, the money was there for him. And the thing is, it was, though administered by the body department, it was always Letters and Science money. So when he retired, the department had to negotiate to get that money.
Oh.
It wasn't department money.
Sure.
They had administered, but it wasn't theirs to decide whether it was part of the budget or not.
Right.
And this is what Ray had to make clear to the department. He went back to the dean to verify that. Yes, this money is to Ray, it is not to the department.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably more complex than that, but
no, but it's very interesting.
But it was a sore point.
Huh.
It was a sore point, and
yeah.
They lost and we won, so
right,
to speak.
Right. Well, then was it dropped pretty much at that point after?
Well, I think after a number of years it was, but it became a negotiating point when we retired that the department went to the dean. I don't know what exactly transpired, but I think it was a negotiating point to keep a professor they wanted to keep was to have money to support an academic staff member for that professor. That was how they kept him. So the money still stayed, quote, unquote, with the department.
Right.
But that's a rarity. I don't know how many positions there are like that. I doubt there are very many of them.
No.
But see, this started out very early when there was a lot more money from the state to do this kind of thing.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, and then so you were here through all those years that the academic staff was surveyed and salary surveys were done. And
yes, and gave us these fancy titles like research program manager. Well, as a matter of fact, something I hadn't mentioned is one of my jobs was to keep track of his research grants. That it was up to me to give him an update every month of where's our money and discuss things that he wanted to either purchase or fund for some reason or another, and decide, well, all right, go down to research administration, contact them and ask them if I can shift dollars from this category to another category. Now, some things you can do automatically without permission from Research Admin and the granting agency, but others you have to get a permission to switch monies. So I had to keep that up, and there was the NSF grant, and sometimes there were smaller grants. There was one from the Agriculture Department. I'm trying to think the name of it. It's but it funds a lot of things here on the agriculture campus.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there were three grants. Sometimes he had a special grant because he was a named professor. And so there was various monies to keep track of. And he wanted me to follow the budget. And mm-hmm. I was expected to do that with his input.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some professors do not keep good track. And then they put the department on the spot as far as getting the money shifted around. And mm-hmm. I had graduate students a couple of times get upset with me. Well, in so-and-so's lab, the grad students get to do this or that. I said, I'm sorry, this is Ray Everett's lab, and he wants me to manage the money, and there is no money for that.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever the reason was.
Right.
But it's usually,
right.
Why can't I pick up the phone and make, you know, call the order myself? And I said, because I'm following the rules. You,
sure.
You can go talk to him if you want to about it, but... And I never ran his budget over. We were mm-hmm. always within a few cents of the exact thing when we closed out a grant, so...
Yeah, that doesn't happen all the time.
It doesn't always
right.
happen,
right.
And so we never cost the department any money. Because
yeah.
sometimes departments have to come up with a difference
mm-hmm.
on some of those. I don't know which aspects, but
mm-hmm.
they probably never paid more than $5 for us. So, but I mean... You know, that's the way it was. He
right.
he said, this is my grant, this is my money, or, well, you know,
mm-hmm.
you follow the rules and make it work right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that
did.
Was a major responsibility to keep track of that. I mean, there were sometimes big shocks where suddenly the grad student pay went up for research assistants and such. Okay. We don't have the money.
Yeah.
And we'd have to sit down and work out, how are you going to pay your graduate students? You know, you took these people on, you promised
right.
them, and we're going to live up to it. So it made some major changes sometimes.
Sure.
That meant you just don't have the money to do certain other things in that program you'd like to do,
yeah.
because he did put the students first. He never dropped, told a student, I can't support you anymore. I don't recall it. I don't,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think he ever had to tell a graduate student, I cannot keep you on anymore. Sometimes there was a lessening of the percentage, but he always made sure that they had something. And
mm-hmm.
it was usually the full amount allotted. So
mm-hmm. interesting. Were you involved at all in any camp committee work outside of the department or other campus activities?
Yes, I was on one committee for some time. Now here again, I can't think of the name of it. It's a committee to determine whether to give an academic staff member full status. What's the word? Permanent job.
Uh-huh.
They have got rolling horizons now and such.
Indefinite status?
Yeah, go from indefinite to, no, I can't think of it. But it was professors from several colleges, and I was the academic staff member on it for a number of years. And you'd get proposals from departments for particular people
mm-hmm.
to give them permanent status. And they weren't handed out very often. And it seemed to me that in retrospect, what we got is, I know that for the agriculture campus, and I know for pharmacy, we were able to give people permanent status. And these were usually academic staff members that filled a very major, major kind of position. People who would run the university farms.
I see.
And things like that where, I mean, those are big managerial positions
right.
and such. People at my level, we're not given it very often.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember, but I wish I could remember the name of that.
Yeah, I can't.
You know, if I thought of it, I could look it up on
right.
my CV,
it was some
which
kind
I
of
wasn't.
Academic staff
it's an
academic committee.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's something like that, and I'm
right.
sure it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And after I was off, it became the Rolling Horizon,
mm-hmm.
where they were able to give people in my level of kind of academic position a guarantee of 2 or 3 years enrolling, so they could, so in other words, they had to guarantee these people jobs for a couple of years if they lost it under the person they were. So I'd say that usually those permanent positions were given to somebody who were on a higher level, like it might be senior scientist or something.
Was
like
it
that.
The area review committee?
Area, right.
Right, just
yes.
came
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but the Rolling Horizon kind of thing came up after I was off that committee. Mm-hmm. That's the only really university committee I
did
was
Did you
ever
enjoy
on.
That? Because that's quite a responsible committee.
Yeah, you had to really read those proposals and think about it and then argue at the table. But they were generally major, major kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I just offhand cannot remember anybody who's kind of at my level, working with a professor with this title.
Right.
Would be given a permanent position,
mm-hmm.
guaranteed position.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea what's happening today,
yeah.
is how many are given.
Right.
But again, you know, it's the money availability kind
sure.
of thing. Yeah.
Sure. Would you talk about the climate for women on the Madison campus? Does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women? And if you want to talk about your department or just what you've seen in general, it's totally up to you.
Well, I really didn't know much about the rest of campus. I would say that in our department, it went pretty well for women. There were a couple cases where they hired women and they didn't work out. And, you know, I suppose if you look at it, they thought we shouldn't have hired her in the first place kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and I haven't looked at the roster right now because there's been quite a bit of overturn in the 5 years I've been gone, or 5 and a half. Though I still have my office, but I'm not up there. I don't work with the people. I don't know them. But it's about a third of the department, or was a third of the department, it was women.
Mm-hmm.
It might be even better than that today, a higher percentage than
mm-hmm.
that today. And that includes, well, I don't know about an assistant, but all ranks. I mean, several of them are full professors.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, in our department, we're probably pretty good. I don't know what the university, overall university situation is. But
what about academic staff? Are there a number of academic staff positions in the botany department? Obviously, you're one
yeah,
of the few
there,
that have.
There are. Now, some of them, here's that, work for the department versus work for a professor.
Oh, yeah.
I think there are very few who work with one professor, and if they do, except for the one who got my position, they're paid out of research grants. Those who are paid by the department are people like the curators in the herbarium,
mm-hmm.
for example, or the artists for the department or the photographer for the department. Those people, well, I should backtrack. Some of those are academic staff and some of those are civil service positions. And I don't know today how many of them are. But there are some academic staff members who, quote, work for the department
mm-hmm.
because they're, but I never was responsible to anybody except Ray Everett
mm-hmm.
in that position. So it wouldn't surprise me that most of the researchers have academic staff, but they're paid out of research grants.
I see.
Yeah.
Right, right. Did you belong to professional organizations when you were working?
Well, yes, I did, but I was never a participant in them, really. I could have. It just didn't interest me. But
mm-hmm.
I did that.
So it didn't necessarily help or...
You
know,
no, because I didn't
work.
Use it as a vehicle to get any place, really. But I thought I should do that to support the field. So there were two or three groups I belonged
mm-hmm.
to. I only belong to one of them now.
I was going to ask you if you traveled at all for your position, but I'm thinking... Hopefully you didn't have to
no,
travel.
No, I didn't travel.
Enough
from
that
no,
personally.
I had enough of that. Right.
Right.
No, I didn't.
Right.
No. So, yeah, and if I recall correctly, the fact that a lot of my time over the years started drifting into a lot of the work was on working on books.
Mm-hmm.
There was always a research component because, I always worked on the manuscripts as far as preparations and such. And I think that was part of the bone of contention, too. But that was checked out, that writing textbooks in your field is part of your academic responsibilities if you wish to direct some of your time to that.
Mm-hmm.
And So it applied to me too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no formal written position on that, but the university lawyers looked over all this material as far as what Ray was doing and what I was doing, and that we were not in conflict with mm-hmm. with anything. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I can understand why you'd want that checked out, but I would certainly, I mean, that would be fairly common, I would think, on the campus that people.
Well, the professor's writing them, but how many academic staff members
work
on it too?
Yeah, that's true.
And also that the fact was that I got some of the royalties, so that also said that, you know, this was within my academic permissions, you might say.
Right, right. Would you comment on any honors or awards that you've received?
I haven't received any.
Well, now you do have emeritus status, right?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Yes, I do. I have emeritus status as an academic staff member. That's mm-hmm. correct. If that's an award or honor, yes,
well,
I do have that.
Not everybody has
no,
that.
No, they don't. No, because we're still working. We're still working on that book, and there was a lab manual with it too. But we're also working on a second book now. In fact, the first volume just came out.
Oh, so you're not employed by the university, but you're still working.
We're still working on the same projects.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Right, have ever since we retired.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Well, it's been a lot of work.
I'll bet. How many hours a week do you work?
For several years, it was 60 and more, 60 and 80 hours a week. When it became production and we were working on several things at the same time,
wow.
it became a real drag in that sense. I mean, I didn't have a life. We just didn't have a life at
yeah.
all. And I must say, both Ray and I are very grateful that we have spouses that don't complain too much
yeah.
about it. You're like, when are we going to see you? When are we going to do anything together?
Right.
Because it really ate up our time.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't have been that way, except the books overlapped in production, and they shouldn't have, and we didn't plan it that way, but that's what happened, and we had to fulfill our obligations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, well, July 1st is when we finished the first volume of the Plant Anatomy book. And that's kind of interesting in itself, is that Ray Everett was the star pupil of Catherine Esau, who was the grand dame of plant anatomy in the world.
Hmm.
She was world-renowned for her work, and he was her star pupil. She gave him the rights to all of her books, and also gave him her apartment in Santa
wow.
Barbara.
Oh, my goodness.
Buy that one, huh?
Oh, yeah.
So, because she always wanted him to have a place where he could study and reflect and write. Well, as I was saying for the tape stop, he goes to Santa Barbara part of the year, and then he sends me his writing. I prepare it and send it back to him so that we're always in contact
mm-hmm.
with that. So he's there, well, when it works out, he's there 3 months about, and then back here the rest of the year. So we keep working, and the first volume just came out this past week. I haven't seen it yet. I'm waiting to see my copy.
How many volumes?
Well, there'll be two on this. The second one, I should be starting right now. I should have started last week. I've got, well, starting the literature searches.
Uh-huh.
Because that's primarily what I'll do right now is find the literature, you know, the current literature for him, and feed it to him, and then he comes back with things, well, I want to see this also. And I may go way back into years and years ago, because he's always been one to follow through from way back,
mm-hmm.
and he's found errors over time that people have mm-hmm. incorporated or misinterpreted, and
mm-hmm.
he straightens them out. So it'll be several years before the second volume will really go into production. And then after that, another book of Catherine Esau's, which is the textbook that she came out with later after doing her Plant Anatomy book, which is more the, you know, a handbook for researchers,
mm-hmm.
is a textbook. And if we both can stand it and live long enough, we'll put out a revision of the anatomy of seed plants. And I didn't tell you the name of the other book.
No.
It's called Biology of Plants, and it's by Raven Everett and Eichhorn. And we're in the seventh edition.
Now, When you said you, that you spent a lot of your time on literature searches, that process has probably changed over the years too, right? In terms of electronic information?
Well, what's helpful are the electronic journals. Mm-hmm. It's because I don't have to go into the libraries and photocopy. Now, I do have to do a fair amount of that if it's older literature
right.
that we can't get. And some journals are gradually putting more and more of their older literature online, but not all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I also take great advantage of the interlibrary loan. It's amazing. In years past, you could have 10 a month
right.
or something like that.
Right.
Now it's unending, and the quality a lot of times isn't great. But the University of Wisconsin has a remarkable collection of literature.
Mm-hmm.
But there are journals that or books that are not here that
sure.
are older, especially,
mm-hmm.
and so the service is very good,
mm-hmm.
and I can do a lot of that online.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I do have to come back to Steenbach a lot, and biology, and sometimes Memorial,
right?
Sometimes other libraries, engineering once in a while. Interesting enough, is a source.
Uh-huh.
Why some of those journals are the ones where somebody writes?
Yeah,
who knows? It might be a courtesy, to somebody else. Well, yes, there's a connection to that kind of journal, and they mm-hmm. publish in it. But most of it's Steenbach, biology, or Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes geography, geology, physics, chemistry.
You're all
it depends.
Yeah.
It just depends on sure. what information he needs to fill out
yeah.
the understanding of what he's reading, so he can either incorporate that or not
mm-hmm.
in his writings.
Mm-hmm.
But he goes through a tremendous amount of literature. It's just phenomenal. He goes through thousands of papers to put out a book.
Hmm.
I don't know how he does
yeah.
it.
Well, you know, that what you just said moves us right into the last two questions, and I think you've answered it, but the category is life after work. If you would describe your family and how did you balance work and family, you kind of talked about that already.
Well, you don't.
Yeah, right.
Basically, you don't.
Yeah.
Up through July 1st of this year, for about 5 years, I virtually had no life at all. I mean, husband was neglected, house neglected, the cats were neglected, my mother was neglected. My mother lives in town now. The rest of my family is neglected, friends are neglected, everything gets neglected.
Yeah.
And it shows after a while that, because you haven't corresponded with people. You know, there's piles of laundry you've done, but you haven't folded them and put them away. So balancing, is not there, not for this kid.
Is it changing?
Yes, very slowly. My house is getting organized. Very slowly, the gardens are coming into shape, et cetera, et cetera. But still, you have to make choices. I mean, if you live up to meeting these deadlines when you're in production, and you have very little time left, you make choices.
Mm-hmm.
And usually mine is go out for a good dinner. The heck with everything else. I'm going out and I'll get a good dinner.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, is that Ike Henry is not a complainer about these things. He'd like to see more of me or spend more time, whatever, but he doesn't complain. And,
mm-hmm.
and if I had somebody to live with who was always complaining, you're not giving me time, you're
mm-hmm.
not this, you're not that, I couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to have the right environment to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Ray's spouse, Mary, and Henry are very glad that we're available.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I had you don't know, well, maybe you do. I mean, I've told you this earlier, is on the phone, was that my husband had a stroke.
You didn't
on June 1st,
mm-hmm.
and it was July 1st when I finished. Unfortunately, if you're going to have that happen to you, it happened, quote, mild, if you call it that, and it was his speech and his whole language abilities. If it had been physical, that would have really, I don't know how I could have gone through that last month.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm glad the volume is out, though I have work to start now for the next one. I have the time to
mm-hmm.
devote to him to help him relearn language.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been terrible if this had happened earlier. I don't know how I would have managed, especially if it was, as I say, physical.
Sure.
So, I mean, physically it's fine, but language, I'm becoming an informal
uneducated speech therapist. So I have to learn to live differently as far as how I interact with him, because sometimes he has to be facing me, or I have to be, or near me, so I can figure out why he's stuck on something.
Mm-hmm.
Because though it's he's improved a great deal, it still help him. And if that had happened long ago, you know, a year or two ago, it might have really said, I can't finish this book. I don't know, but I mean, there's certain things you have to do. That is something I have to do.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So it was going to happen. It happened at about the right time. And also that it was his language. And fortunately, he's got a kind of aphasia that he improves. Some people never improve.
Oh, good.
So
that's good. That's
so, I mean, there's
good
in this badness, there's goodness.
Right, right. So. Well, this question isn't on the paper, but I have to ask you this then. How did you keep up your health and your energy while you were doing all of this? I mean,
I guess basically I have good health.
Yeah.
Don't get the exercise I should.
Well, it sounds like you're around campus though quite a bit.
Well, yeah, sometimes, but a lot of times, as I say, work out of the house, because
yeah.
It's a lot of it's online. But then when it comes to production and things, then Ray and I have to be together to
sure.
work on it, right next to each other, either proofreading or deciding on what artwork to use and how to crop it and whether we should use it or shouldn't use it, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But basically I'm pretty good health, so...
Well, that's good. Well, the questions are over, but I don't want to stop the tape until if there's anything else you haven't said that you would like to get on the tape that we haven't covered.
Oh. Now, off the top of my head, no, but there might be.
Well, if you...
I tried to go back when I thought of things. I'll tell you something I miss.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
But
it goes
way back, really. And this is something that, when I have the opportunity, I tell graduate students, is these are going to be the best years of your life, practically. That you're not going to be able to replace them.
Hmm.
You're going to have interaction with people that you're not going to get when you're a professor or out in the fields, in whatever kind of job you take. And graduate students, days can be very tough, you know, the pressure to, you know, studies and research and writing and all that kind of thing. But the camaraderie that you can gain at that time is mm-hmm. just something you do not forget and you cannot replace. So I tell them, use it, take advantage of the chance to work with, you know, interact with your fellow graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I became an academic staff member and was no longer a student and staff, it's outside of my lab, it disappeared.
Yeah.
And you're not in the professor's group, you're not in the grad student's group, you're in between.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you've got some kind of bond with somebody in another lab and you get invited, you're not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's anything you can do about it. It's
mm-hmm.
that's just the way life goes. Is you're part of a group or not. It's silly. And there are probably labs where that, or departments where that doesn't happen. But I think it's very common that
mm-hmm.
your graduate student years are precious years, and you're only going to get them while you're a graduate student.
Excellent advice. Yeah.
And speaking of advice, I've sometimes had the opportunity to tell women, I said, if you don't have a spouse now, if you do someday, be sure he or she's in a different field. That sounds ridiculous, but so often, and maybe it doesn't happen as much today, but spousal hires were just not around when years back. And I don't know how good it is today. I know it happens here, but in other places. But if you're in the same field, you know, you're both in botany or zoology or something, good heavens. If one's in law and one's in science, maybe fine, but and you're both on campus. But if you're academics and you're in the same field,
I mean, a lot of people just don't get the chance to develop their careers very much,
sure,
because there just isn't money to hire both of you.
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't want to because you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You really should be in different things. So I tell them. Another one is I say, don't change your name. Or if you keep a name, always use the same initials. This drives me nuts. I'm trying to find somebody. I don't know if it's the same Brown. You know,
right.
If it was a librarian, perhaps you know this, is that I don't know if this is the same person or not, because they keep
right.
one issue, they can use one name, and another issue, a journal, an article, they use a different name or different initials.
Right.
You know, let us know. You know, be consistent.
Yeah.
Now, that's silly. It sounds silly, but if you're
no.
doing a lot of bibliographies, I think, is it or is not the same person?
Sure. Sure.
And if you don't know those people personally, sometimes you can't figure out whether it's
yeah.
the same person.
Yeah.
And you don't want to, you know, lump somebody in the, quoting them incorrectly because it's the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
But those are my pieces of advice.
Very good. Thank you. Well, this was an excellent interview, and I really appreciate listening to people like you who are so enthusiastic and so passionate about what they do. You know, that we are so fortunate on this campus, I think, to have had people like you who are, you know, not only willing, but want to come in and spend those 50 and 60 hours on these projects, because it's so important, and it you know, makes us the world-class university that we are.
Yeah. I don't recommend that kind of hour. And you have to be very careful in choosing it and how you're going to balance things.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something that, when both Henry and I were here at the university and graduate students, is we always saved Friday night for ourselves and friends. Always. We never were, unless you went in the lab late after you had dinner or something, which that was rare, but it's kind of, if you don't make time for yourself and family and friends now,
mm-hmm.
will you ever?
Right.
I don't know, but I mean, there are people like, oh, I can't, I've got to be in the lab, I've got to work. I don't know what graduate students do who aren't in labs. I mean, they maybe go to the library, but you've just got to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense for anybody, but grad school can be so time-consuming in itself. You really have to make time, and maybe only a couple hours. It may just go to a movie, come home. But we always made it a point to get together with others, either at our home or at a restaurant. And you had to eat cheaply back then, because that's all we had.
Yeah.
So that's something I'd say, too, is
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
don't forget your graduate student years. But within that, do go out.
Right, right. Well, thank you very much.
You're
for
most
taking
welcome.
The time. We have an addendum to this recording. Please tell the story.
Why don't you state why you asked me?
Okay. Well, what I had said was that I think it would be a good idea if we could get some of these tapes that we've been making for the Oral History Project up to state legislators when they're first elected, so that they have a better understanding of the kind of work that goes on here and how important it is.
And dedication to so many hours,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, the dedication and the hours that people put in these positions.
All right, what prompted my interviewer here to ask, get back to this addendum, was hours spent and how late. Well, back in 1970, I guess it was August of 1970, when the university was bombed, I was one of the persons that the FBI called about it. And the reason that I was called, apparently, was because the department chair, or somebody like him, was asked, who works late in the building? And mm-hmm. my name was one of the ones that came up. And I was called, apparently, to, did I see anything?
Mm-hmm.
Well, fortunately, that, for us, but not for our fellow researchers next door at Sterling Hall, was we were out of there by midnight or 1 o'clock, and the bombing didn't happen until something like 4 o'clock. And as it was, is at least one window of our laboratory area faced Sterling Hall. So we lost, and we lost all of our windows except one section on the north side of one window. And our people or others could have been there,
sure,
because we do work late.
Mm-hmm.
And but as I say, quote, fortunately, unquote, it was later hours. But it, you know, it could have been our people could have been up there, and
could have been you.
It could have been myself, yes, mm-hmm, because my office was the one that faced the early hall.
Yeah.
But yeah, because there were shards of glass embedded in the steel frame of my door. So if it can, a piece of glass a couple of inches long can stick in my door frame,
right,
that's metal, you can imagine how it would affect me if I were sitting there when it,
yeah,
happened.
Yeah.
But fortunately, none of our people were up there that night, at least not at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, speaking of how long people work, it,
right,
wasn't just the unfortunate researcher in Sterling Hall who was,
mm-hmm,
killed.
Mm-hmm.
There are other people who are around really, really late.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the addendum is.
Yeah, I'm glad we got that on tape. Thank you.
There's something else I'd like to add about my life while I was employed, and that is a personal thing. I belong to the National Women's Political Caucus, and back in 1986, I was a board member, and I was assigned the task of coming up with an idea for a fundraiser. I thought, I can't raise money. I don't know what to do. Well, a little time passed, and I didn't know what to do, and in the mail one day came a postcard, and it was the announcement of an art show down in Stoughton at the Signature Gallery. And I glanced at the list and said it was a women's art show, and one of the persons is a friend of mine. I thought, well, I have to go down there. So I, nice day, and I went down to Stoughton, and I walked into the gallery, and it was one of those old buildings that has a two-story high ceiling and a painted tin ceiling, and there was furniture around and hardwood floors and art all around, and I thought it was a very lovely place. And I inquired about some art of one of the artists, a piece that had already been sold, and I asked, is there anyone that could tell me where else she has some art? Well, I was given her phone number, and I called her, and she told me where I could find other pieces of her art. And so I wrote those all down and put it aside. And then about a day later, it was a sunny day, and I was walking through my living room, and we have white walls, and they'd just been painted, and the floors refinished, and I was putting my plants around, and I thought, my gosh, it's smaller, but it looks like the art gallery. I thought, maybe that's an idea. So I pondered it and didn't think too much more of it. And several days later, I went to find this woman's art in these places around town. And I went to several places, and I ended up with one called the Heidemann Gallery. And the woman there was very charming, and I just threw this idea of mine at her. And she said, a woman's art show? That sounds wonderful. And she said, where? I said, in my home. She said, I'll have to see your home. So she came over to my house one day, and she came in the kitchen entrance, which most people do because our house is turned on the lot, so our front door doesn't face any street. And she got partway through the kitchen towards the dining room, and she said, perfect. She hadn't even seen anything else in the house, but she said, perfect. She said, I'd love to do a show for you. I'll hang it for you.
Yeah.
Well, there I had the place. Huh. I had a person who would help. How do I get the art? And so we had a meeting coming up, and I said, well, I have an idea for the fundraiser. And I went through it, and somebody said, well, would this woman charge us? And I said, well, I don't know. She didn't say anything. I said, well, call her up. If she's charging us, we can't afford it, kind of idea. And I called her back. She said, well, of course, for nothing. I always get involved in promoting art. So I said, okay. I said, well, then I've got to find the artist. Well, I had, between my own thoughts and this woman's thoughts, her name is Donna Heidemann, and a suggestion that we go to the Wisconsin Arts Board to talk to someone, we managed to pull a show together. And most people don't know how we did it, but I did it. I took a painting of one of these women, the woman I called, and I took her painting to a friend who photographed it for me, and we made postcards to advertise the show. So we wrote out a couple thousand cards and mailed them out.
And that was just to announce the show. We didn't have the artists put together yet. And there was a suggestion made by the Arts Board that we have some known artists in town to, as a draw. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh my gosh, I've heard of some of these people, but they're not going to come to my house for a little show. Well, I wrote them, you know, bought nice cards with woman-oriented art on it, and wrote. They all said yes. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is fantastic. Now, we still don't have the artists. We have some guest artists, but we don't have any artists. Well, I really can't remember how we got them. We put some advertisement out. I don't remember which it was. Any rate, we got, I don't remember how many people. I didn't put my data together, but we had a nice group of people entering. And then one of the suggestions from the Art Board was we should have a juror to make it more legitimate kind of a show. I said, okay. And where do I get one? She said, well, just call the university and check their art department, see if there's somebody who'd be glad to judge the show. So I said, oh, okay. So we had a judge come out and look at all the art that we had received, and she tossed some things out that I thought should be in. I thought, well, okay, it's just one time. Didn't think too much about it. So the decision was made that we'd have this show for just 1 week, and that's what our card said, and it would be an admission charge of $5. And we decided if we broke even, we might do a second show, but it was no guarantee. Well, the show came off. I can't remember too much of the details now, but we did pull it off, and the women who were in the show seemed so interested in being in it. And we had some music. We had a young friend who plays the flute, and she brought a friend with a guitar, so we had a little bit of music. And we had a couple bouquets of flowers from Flourishes. And the show was over. The artists came to pick up their work, and they said, several said, are you going to do this again? I said, well, we didn't really know. We broke even. Said, oh, you must do this again. We have so few opportunities. Huh. So the next board meeting after this, we said, okay, we'll do it again, but we'll do it for 2 weeks. And so things just kind of gel as you go along. And they said, if you really want to do that to your house again, all those holes in your walls. I said, well, that's okay. You know, we'll get covered up. I don't worry about this. Well, to make a really long story shorter, we did the show for 15 years. And for 15 years, there are holes banged in my walls, and they've never been painted. Haven't been painted yet. And it developed into what a lot of people thought was a really beautiful show. So over the years, what had developed is that I had bought back earlier in the 80s some glass vases hang on the wall. I only had three of them. Well, the Flourishes put flowers in them. And somebody said, my gosh, where did you get those? I said, well, an art gallery out in Massachusetts. And so over a couple of years, we were trying to figure out, well, how can we get more of these vases? Well, we finally found a glass artist in Madison, and she made vases for us. And so eventually, over time, we sold lots of vases to people, and I had about 40 of these on my walls. So when the art was hung, we had all these vases on the walls with flowers that Flourishes put in. And by about the second year or so, we had a harp player. So we had harp music. We had all these flowers, plus a couple big bouquets. And about the second or third year, we started something called Artful Woman of the Year. So we would have this big brunch on one Sunday of the show. I should point out that when I say 2 weeks, it's really the weekend, Saturday and Sunday only. Okay. So there was no more than 4 days of the show. And it was a marvelous experience to have all this art. Well, one of the problems that occurred over the years is the women on the board thought, you know, these jurors are throwing out art that we like. And in spite of the fact that I'd explained to them that this is an opportunity show, it's for fun, and I hope to sell some art for the artist's sake and make some money for the organization. Mm-hmm. Well, it got to the point where we decided, why don't we judge the show ourselves? So we as a committee, art committee, would select the art to be in. Now, it was always some things thrown out that somebody liked because we had to have a consensus of what would be in. But we would beat it down to what we wanted because we felt people were being thrown out who should not be because the show was opportunity. These were not necessarily people who were good artists. They wanted to have their art shown mm-hmm. to the family, friends. and give them a trial. How are they doing? And we found out in this 15-year process, well, we found out fairly early on, is that even the best artists are thrown out of shows. They don't get in. Who knows why? And the jury's not going to tell you. So what we did after a number of years and selected the art for the show ourselves is then we would ask an artist or a gallery owner, somebody involved in the arts, and say, you come over and choose the prizes. And the guest artists were not allowed to be in that category. It had to be artists who were juried in. And it was such a marvelous experience.
Sounds like it.
Hard to imagine that I ever did this, and people thought I was nuts to have all these holes put in the wall, but it didn't bother me. I don't see them for the most part.
Yeah.
And we had interesting things happen. Once in a rare while, a juror would say, please tell this artist this. It might be on framing or some element she put in that just detracted. That was rare, maybe three or four times out of the whole 15 years we had go to somebody and say this. So it was a little hard to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. Your piece is in the show, however.
Now, has someone carried on this?
Well, about the time around the 14th show, I thought, I can't handle this anymore. I've got other things to do. And so I mentioned it to my friend Donna Heidemann, who had hung every show for us. She decided where everything went. I had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm glad you brought that up. She said, because it's getting very hard for me to do the lifting and hang all this. Mm-hmm. So we decided, okay, next year, which was 2001, would be our last show in my house. And the show has been carried on since, but I have nothing to do with it. It's not an opportunity show anymore. My understanding is that they select the artists they want. And I'm not sure. I don't want to be held to that. But mm-hmm. But it is not the same kind of show. It doesn't have the music and the flowers mm-hmm. and the home ambience of seeing art in a home. And it has been held several times in the University of Wisconsin Hospital Lounge. There's that big lounge that they often have art hanging on mm-hmm. it, and that's where the show has been several times. So I said I'd be there to advise them or give them information, but they haven't approached me. It's their show. You know, it's still Artful Women, but mm-hmm. it's their show, whoever is putting it together now.
This is great practical advice for people listening. I'm sure there's many people that are in that kind of situation, and what do you do?
I doubt there are many people who would devote almost their entire home, at least the first and second floors, we also have a big attic, to a show. All those people traipsing through on their floors and all the holes in the walls. And as I say, people said, you're nuts, Susan, but keep doing it.
right.
And it was a wonderful experience because I got exposed to a lot of art, in fact, that I hadn't before because mm-hmm. there were different things that I never really paid attention to. I mean, I'm not a real great appreciator of abstract art, but there were some very interesting pieces there that I'd see them in different times of the day with different light on them, and it makes a difference seeing it in a home. When you mm-hmm. see art surrounded by a home setting, you get a very different impression of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And we had some people that we saw over the years who kept entering, and their art improved. And we learned something else was that a lot of the younger people, some of the, for example, students here at the university who would enter, is that they can't afford to frame everything.
Oh, sure.
And so they were wondering. So we had a question one time: could I enter it? I don't have a frame. I just can't afford it unless I'm going to be in the show. So we eventually, after about a year or two, came down to, okay, you can enter it unframed, but it must be matted and have a protective cover on it,
mm-hmm.
Because people bring in pastels and such, you know, all the chalk dust is coming off. I mean, whoa.
Yeah.
And one year we did something, only once we did this, is I had been over to the I said, Donna, I said, who drew this or painted this picture? It was a very simple, bright, primary colors of a swing and a tree. She said, well, it's a 10-year-old girl. And I said, well, I want to be in the show. It's better than some of the things I've seen by adult women. And she said, all right, I'll frame it, we'll enter it. Well, what happened was that we said anybody, any age could enter. So we had not only this 11-year-old girl, but the grandchildren of a couple others. They were like 5, 7 years old. Well, you could tell some of them were very, very young. Well, when this came to the time of entering the art, bringing the art over, I had one artist say, she said, I've got a friend who's an artist, very good artist, and she will not enter this show because it's not serious. You've got children. Well, we didn't say anything, but the group decided later, look, it was one time. This show's always been for fun. Mm-hmm. If we can do what we want. We're not trying to promote people in the arts. I mean, if they get promoted, that's fine with us. And we thought, well, what do we do? Because we had a couple 15, 14-year-olds, a little bit older. And so we decided high school age, which can be 13 and older.
Sure.
So mm-hmm. we never put an age on it again. We just said high school age on up. Mm-hmm. And that resolved the question of, you know, because we weren't trying to do a children's art, though it's very interesting, but let somebody else do the really
right.
young people, because I've seen some wonderful things by young people. Mm-hmm. So we came up with all kinds of little things like that, and it was interesting to watch people who visited the show, in fact, to watch children, because many times parents would drag their little kids along, and when you see a child stop and look at a piece of art, you want to know, why did that child stop? And I noticed that they stopped at things that were very imaginative, like found art, when artists will take various elements they find and build something out of it. Mm-hmm. And I've seen children just stop in front of one of those pieces and look at all these little things they saw put together. So, I mean, art appreciation can start at a very young age.
Sure.
And so, I mean, there are lots of little things like that that just made the show a delight to do. But it did become, it tied up my life so much in the spring, and I was going to retire, or maybe I had just retired, as a matter of fact. And I thought, I've got other things to do. It's time for it to move on.
Are you still involved in the Women's Political Caucus?
Yes, but we're not. It's not too active a group at the
it?
Moment. No, but it still exists, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it gets fired up when there's a lot of politics going on.
Well, that'll happen soon then, I think.
Probably,
yeah,
yes.
Right.
But that's nothing to do with the university per se, and I never imagined that a one-year time fundraiser would turn into 15 times.
Well, again, it's a great story, and I'm certainly glad that we got it on tape, because I'm sure that'll be interesting to a lot of people.
I'm sure it will be.
Right. Well, thank you again
for you're most welcome.
Agreeing to do this.
It's been delightful.